The transfer of power can be pretty brutal and clinical, even in a modern Western democracy, can't it? You know, Mrs. May drives to the palace as Prime Minister and returns as a backbencher. And some 30 minutes later, her place in number 10 is taken by Boris Johnson. Well, it's happening here too. Chapter 15 begins with Saul as the king. Chapter 16 ends with David as the man. Of course, under the surface, Mrs. May has been a lame duck prime minister for the last 6 weeks since she announced her resignation. Some would say for many months longer, as the factions in her party left her a dead woman walking. Saul was not prime minister, he was king. And the crown was firmly on his head. But this is a story of rejection, of how his impatience, his arrogance, his insecurities have meant God has rejected him as king. And for the next 30 years or so, he'll still go on wearing the crown, but as a lame duck king. There's a sign of it at the very end of chapter 15. Look at that last verse. Samuel is God's prophet, and we're told, until the day Samuel died, he did not go to see Saul again. See, Saul is still on the throne, but a king without God's word, an uncomfortable place to rule God's people from. You can follow the crown, but don't imagine it tells us all we need to know. And this chapter, amongst all the characters that are there, is really a story about God, the God who provides. Even as the story moves on and moves away from Saul, there is real engagement, emotional engagement. This is not some heartless clinical coup. Look again at that final verse of the previous chapter, verse 35 of chapter 15. It talks about Samuel mourned for Saul. Not for the frustration he caused, not for the nation and the mess it found itself in, though he may well have mourned for those, but for Saul himself. And Samuel has been very straight with him, told him face to face, a red line has been crossed, God wouldn't have him back, this was the end of the line. And yet still he has room to mourn for the man and the shipwreck of his ministry. It's a healthy reminder to us when a leader falls from grace or a church drifts from the gospel, a good protective check in the swirl of emotions those things can bring up. You know, anger at the deceit and the lies and the rebellion, compassion for the manipulated, the abused, the deceived. Good if we can find the space to leave room for mourning and grief for the one who has made shipwreck of himself. Shipwreck of herself, shipwreck of their ministries. To shed a tear over a church or a denomination turning its back on the God of grace. It spares us from an ungodly arrogance or a pharisaical spirit of condemnation, and we evangelicals all too easily slide over there. You know, it's not hard to find something to speak against in the Church of England, but we are heard grieving far less often. And watch God's response as well. You see how that final verse ends, the last sentence of chapter 15. And the Lord regretted that he'd made Saul king over Israel. It was an appointment full of ambiguities, God's choice, but not God's initiative. There may not have been a referendum, but the idea of having a king came by popular demand. And it's as if God's saying, well, this is what you wanted, here's what you get, and that's how it turns out. The sovereignty of God doesn't mean that he approves of everything a leader does. He regretted. You know, like a parent watching a child make poor church choices and having to live with the consequences. He regretted. Oddly reassuring that you can say that of God. He doesn't just shrug his shoulders and say, well, you win some, you lose some. In spite of their defiance, he's still invested in his people. And that's where our chapter opens up. Chapter 16, verse 1, the Lord said to Samuel, "How long will you mourn for Saul, since I've rejected him as king over Israel?" Yeah, there comes a time when that heavy heart and those tears have lost sight of the bigger picture, have forgotten God's righteous rejection. And God isn't going to leave his people without a leader. So fill your horn with oil, Samuel, and be on your way. Samuel needs to move on in every sense of the words. "I'm sending you to Jesse of Bethlehem. I've chosen one of his sons to be king." Literally, I've provided for myself one of his sons to be king. The people may have defied God in demanding a king. They may have reaped the messy consequences, but God's not given up on them. He's the God who provides. And he's the God who chooses. Because this chapter is all about God choosing a leader for his people. And it's not like a Tory party election to leadership with the result publicly announced. This is far more dangerous. Look at verse 2. See, but Samuel said, "How can I go? If Saul hears about it, he'll kill me." Now, if the crown is on one head, to anoint someone else as king seems remarkably like treason. And Saul is not don't think of him as some kind of constitutional monarch with all kinds of conventions about how you go about doing these things. He's much more the warlord king. Threaten his position and you do it at your peril. And God knows the problem, of course. So verse 2 goes on, "The Lord said, 'Take a heifer with you and say, I've come to sacrifice to the Lord.' The cow, the heifer, makes for good cover for the real purpose of the trip. Invite Jesse to the sacrifice and I'll show you what to do. You're to anoint for me the one I indicate." And all the way through the chapter, God is controlling the selection process. Now, Samuel isn't the only one on edge. You notice when he reaches Bethlehem, the first question to him is there in verse 4, "Do you come in peace?" Samuel remembers a prophet and a judge. A visit to a village like Bethlehem would be a rarity, easy for it to trigger all kinds of fears. You know, if you're a driver, you know that moment when you suddenly look out of your window and there next to you is a police car? Yeah, and for a nanosecond, your brain is instantly asking, how did it get there? Only for a nanosecond, because your brain very quickly computes there's a far more urgent question to answer, which is, what have I done wrong? You know, and the guilt trip sends you rerunning the last 5 miles of driving to see what the reason is. Oh, it's a bit like that here. You know, word has gone on ahead of him. Samuel is coming. And you know, every conscience is coming to the surface. Who told him about that fraudulent land deal you put together? How did he know that I'm behind on my debt repayments? Or if you are the first people to meet him, the elders of the village, you have an elder question in this, which isn't anything as specific as that. It's, what does he know about we don't even know about? Do you come in peace? Yes, in peace. I've come to sacrifice to the Lord. And you can almost hear that sense of relief. Phew, he's just here for religion, which feels a lot safer. Only, of course, he's here for far more than that. The heifer hides plenty. So the elders and Jesse and the sons get invited to the sacrifice and the party later that day. And you can imagine them lining up for the formal handshake or whatever with Samuel. And Samuel's fingering the horn of oil attached to his belt, ready to act as soon as God gives him the nod. And it's eldest first, Eliab. And Samuel's eyes light up, verse 6. "Surely the Lord's anointed stands here before the Lord." Eliab is Samuel's choice, yeah, but not God's. Verse 7. "But the Lord said to Samuel, 'Do not consider his appearance or his height. The Lord does not look at the things people look at. People look at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart.'" Now, here's the key verse. Here's the key truth for the whole selection process. I can remember a rather awkward conversation my mother tried to have with me. I was a sort of young teenager at the time, and It was about girls. And I think she kind of half thought I ought to have a girlfriend, but even more importantly, it had to be the right girl. And she was just talking about one or two girls that were sort of around the edge of the family and everything. And she mentioned one that I think she rather liked, and she was probably thinking I was going to ignore. And she came out with a sentence a bit like this. She said, Hugh, she may not be an oil painting, but you know, it's the inside that counts, not the outside. Well, look, I was just a young teenager. I hadn't realized I was meant to be looking for an oil painting. But as a young teenager, I'm sure I was rather hoping that at least we could have an outside that counted as well as an inside. I've never forgotten her comment, and not, I suspect, entirely because of its wisdom. And I've no idea if she knew where the idea behind it came from. People look at the outward appearances, but the Lord looks on the heart. And he needs to say it because we need to hear it. Because externals matter so much to us, and we all get dazzled by the packaging. And even Samuel seemed drawn to Eliab because of his height. As if Saul's height, head and shoulders above others, was an essential in spite of his failures. And God has to say to him, Samuel, I'm not looking for a tall man, I'm looking for a king. People look at the outward appearance. It's amazing how much we compute about one another from outward appearances. You know, anything, schooling, education, ethnicity, looks, fashion sense, social skills, charisma, ambition. Years and years later, the Apostle Paul would make a similar point describing the young Christian church at Corinth. It's as if he looked around it and said, not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many of you were influential. Not many of you were of noble birth. People look at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. Now, understand this, that the heart in Bible thought is the seat of intentions and will, much more than it's the seat of emotions and feelings. This isn't about nice feelings someone has about God, or even about nice feelings God has about them. When later on David is described as a man after God's own heart, it's not saying this is God's favorite. It's saying here's someone who will do God's will. And one by one, the sons file past Samuel, and one by one he has to say, the Lord's not chosen this one. The Lord's not chosen this one. No, the Lord's not chosen this one. Seven times in total. And he comes to the end of the line, and you can almost sense Samuel's confusion, can't you? I mean, he's been sent there to anoint one of Jesse's sons, and God will indicate him, and every one of them seems to have been ruled out. So verse 11, he asked Jesse, are these all the sons you have? Well, they're still the youngest, Jesse answered, and he's tending the sheep. Now, I speculate here, but I can't help wondering if this was deliberate. If David wasn't a bit of a wild one. Now, out on the hillside with the sheep, practicing with his sling and stones, I very much doubt that the stone that killed Goliath was beginner's luck. If you went out there on the hillside, you'd probably get a warning shot across your bows if you went out to meet him. He was accurate enough to be able to aim to just miss. And the kind of guy who's willing to take that risk just so he could laugh at your reaction. You know, that sort of wild one. And back home, of course, he'd take himself off to his room and endlessly strum his guitar, trying out new chords, always noisily, sometimes tunefully. And if a dignitary like Samuel was visiting the village, it was probably a good thing for his parents' nerves if he was out tending the sheep. But he can't stay there, verse 11. Send for him, we won't sit down until he arrives. No food until they've found him. So he sent for him and had him brought in, and he was glowing with health and had a fine appearance and handsome features. And when we looked at this passage the other day as a ministry team, as we came to this verse, you could hear an audible sigh of relief from Pele Ling. He really knew, so you can be handsome and still qualify. When the student team looked at it, one of their leaders said, oh great, you don't have to be ugly to be a leader. See, handsome features did not disqualify David, but they weren't what qualified him either. The Lord looks on the heart. So not David, the perfect moral character, but a man committed to doing God's will and God's purposes. And then the Lord said, rise and anoint him. Jesse would never have guessed it, nor Samuel, but this is God's choice. People look on the outward appearance, but God looks on the heart. It's why people can look so different and yet be used by God. Actually, we should expect differences in outward appearances if that's not where God is looking. You know, you take someone like Tobias Brown, who heads up our fellowship group ministry here. Tobias is Afro-American. So you see, he's black, I'm white. He's handsome, I'm less than. He's a fashionable, cool dude. Well, my kids would remind me, I can't even say I'm past it because I never got there in the first place. He has an appallingly terrible, rebellious background. I have an impressively respectable, rebellious background. None of those things are reasons why we're here. The Lord looks on the heart. And he sees what we so often miss. Peter was a school I used to go two or three times a year to speak to the little Christian union in that school. And in his last year, Peter was made the leader of the Christian union. There wasn't actually a lot of choice. There would be about six or seven people there. If he made double figures, revival had broken out. And it wasn't a sort of great meeting. We'd sit around in a bit of a circle, munch a biscuit, try some idle chatter. And I remember the first time Peter was leading with me, after this had gone on for a bit, Peter looked at me, screwed up his face, and just nodded at me. And the third time he did it, I realized that was my introduction. Well, it was all the introduction I was going to get from Peter. I was meant to go ahead and run the meeting. Peter had a good education, but there were sort of no great brains to talk about. He certainly wasn't sporty, and he had precious few social skills. But as time went by, Peter left school. He'd spent a year as a kind of teaching assistant in another school. And in that year, Peter stood up to the head over a moral issue in the school. He lent a boy a booklet and told him enough of the gospel to lead him to Christ. He encouraged a lay minister who was also on the staff there and had been for many years to start reading the Bible for himself again. People look on outward appearances, and Peter won't feature on their radar screens. The Lord looks on the heart and sees a Peter who'll do his will. The God who provides, the God who chooses, the God who anoints. Verse 12, then the Lord said, rise and anoint him. This is the one. Now that's how Samuel knows. That's the only way Samuel knows. So verse 13, Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the presence of his brothers. And from that day on, the Spirit of the Lord came powerfully upon David. And this, by the way, is the first time any of us know that it's David. Samuel then went to Ramah. The Spirit of the Lord came powerfully upon David. Verse 14, now the Spirit of the Lord had departed from Saul. It couldn't be clearer that power has shifted, that everything has changed. Yet at another level, nothing has changed. The crown stays on Saul's head. The establishment, the structures of power and leadership remain just where they were. But the anointing is clearly on David. The establishment looks to one king. God encourages us to look to another. And the rest of the story in this book tells of the playing out of the tensions between the crown and the anointed one. Giving the respect, the high respect God gives to the crown, to any government authority. and yet ultimate loyalty, the deepest bowing of the knee being given to the Anointed One. And it's not a tension confined to one generation or one nation in history. The psalmist wrote about it. Listen to Psalm 2. It tackles on the macro scale our constant rebellion where we want to play God. Why do the nations conspire and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth rise up and the rulers band together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let's break their chains and throw off their shackles. The one enthroned in heaven laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. He rebukes them in his anger, terrifies them in his wrath, saying, I have installed my king on Zion, my holy mountain. Now, the Anointed One, of course, is ultimately not David, but great David's greatest son, God's Messiah, Jesus himself. Leah Sharibu is the Nigerian schoolchild abducted with about 100 others by Boko Haram last year. Boko Haram, in a sense, in northern Nigeria, have the crown, the power. But Leah is the one girl of that group still in their hands because she refused to even pretend to deny Jesus and convert to Islam. That would have got her her freedom, but she insisted on staying loyal to the Anointed One. Now, the tension hasn't reached that level in the UK, but increasingly in the classroom, on the campus, at different workplaces, more and more in the public square, Christians are having to face the risks and pay the price of standing by the anointed, the eventual ultimate king, Jesus, while the crown, for now, stays on other heads. And it's the same in the world of religion. Even when leaders prove false and churches and denominations become apostate, their establishment exterior often remains. They still have the titles. They've still got the outfits. They still enjoy the social acceptance. And we mustn't let that fool us. In the end, and we need to remember it in a day when again and again we feel let down by leaders. In the end, there is only one who leads with complete integrity. And he was born in the Bethlehem Samuel went to, in a manger of all places. And if you think it was a stable, a back room, a cave, it doesn't matter, whatever. It was the wrong postcode if you wanted to impress. And he died on a cross, a criminal's execution, ugly and twisted. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him, Isaiah writes. And yet he is the Messiah the Lord has anointed. People look at the outward appearances, but the Lord looks at the heart. And he says of Jesus what he said of David, this is the one. Tim Chester wrote some powerful words, which are just worth hearing again. He said this, Christian worship is always a subversive act, akin to singing the French national anthem in occupied France during World War II. Now, I suspect very few of us thought we were coming to church this morning to take part in a subversive act. You probably thought you'd actually come to do something very conventional. Some probably thought they were coming to do something boringly conventional. But Chester goes on, in our corporate worship, when we're together, we call one another both to the worship of the true God and from the worship of other gods. We call one another from the subtle influence of the empty and destructive idolatries of this world, and instead we give our undivided allegiance to the one undivided God. We come together to make sure we don't just drift through Monday to Saturday with allegiances tugged in all kinds of directions, but to renew them clearly. We come together to renew our allegiance. And the Lord says of Jesus, this is the one. And we say, this is the one for me. So sing this last song subversively, will you? Loudly, confidently, subversively, this is the one for me. Hail to the Lord's anointed.